Welcome back to the program. Many of you have heard all the arguments, both pro and con, about blogging. Many think that blogs are a wondrous innovation, a key that's unlocked vast resources of self-expression and allowed people to express themselves in ways heretofore unheard of. And yet others see blogs as a scourge, debasing journalism, undermining traditional forms of authority, and drowning us all in meaningless chatter. We're going to spend some time talking about blogs, what they really mean, and what their future might be with my guest, Scott Rosenberg. He's a co-founder of Salon.com, where he served as managing editor for quite some time. He's the author of the previous book, Dreaming in Code, and it is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his new work, Say Everything, How Blogging Began, What It's Becoming, and Why It Matters. It's just published by Crown. Scott Rosenberg, welcome to the program.
My pleasure.
First of all, how did blogs get started?
They started really in the mid-90s, a long time ago now, almost 15 years, as people began to realize that the web, in fact, let them publish. And it started, as so many things on the web do, among software developers who made it easier for other people to do this, and then it spread from there to people who were obsessed with politics, people who were interested in exploring them in business and popular culture, and, you know, this sort of expanding circle.
Right. And as you point out, all of these things have their own kind of unique evolution in that those that developed the software for this, the concept of this, didn't really imagine the degree to which it would take off, the degree to which it would become so ingrained in our culture today.
You know, it's interesting because that's true for most of us. There were a few people, and these are the people that I really start in Say Everything, telling their stories, who did have this vision early on. They looked at the web and they thought, you know what, someday everybody's going to be doing this. And it's fascinating to me as someone, I was a print journalist from the San Francisco Examiner before I was on the web, and those of us who arrived online with that background had a much harder time seeing this than people who were sort of outsiders and who kind of had that vision.
Was it really that journalists and those that came from that background had a harder time seeing it, or there was a certain kind of inherent fear, a certain sense that this somehow was not going to be a good development for traditional journalism?
You know, the fear did arrive, but it came later. At the beginning, I think it was so hard for people to picture that it was more of a kind of blindness. You know, when there's a new media form that arrives, we always start by just thinking it's going to be another version of what we know. And it takes time for us to get our heads around the real differences.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the evolution of these things is always that they have some element of what we know, and then they kind of morph into something different.
That's right. And so with blogs, what started, we understood some earlier forms. We understood the diary. We understood lists of links and these things. And it was hard to do at the beginning. And what people discovered at some point was that a simple organization for a website with new stuff on top made sense. And I'd been an editor. I was used to sitting in meetings where we spent hours deciding what went on top, what was going to be the lead story. And, you know, that still has value. But for most people publishing on the web, it's so much simpler to just put something new on top. You don't have to think. Each time you post something, it's just there.
Mm-hmm. Talk about what the pushback to that was at some point, the idea that it was unmediated in that sense.
Well, there's been, you know, the pushback comes in several different forms. People have very, you know, legitimate and understandable concerns about, you know, what happens when there's no filter, when there's no editor. And the concern that people have is sort of shaped by their experience with a media world that's limited. So if there's only 24 hours in a day on a TV station, what you say in that time is important, what choices you make. On the web, though, there's sort of an unlimited airtime. When I choose to post something, it doesn't stop you from posting anything. So what happens is the filtering gets done afterwards. The filtering gets done by who links to you. If you post something and it's wrong, eventually people are going to point that out. If you're a person of conscience, you're going to take it down or correct it or whatever. So there's a whole different dynamic. It's sort of more like almost like an ecological system mm-hmm. of information rather than a kind of command control system, which is what we used to have.
And to what extent did the sort of inherent cultural narcissism that continues to grow in society play a role in the explosion of blogs?
What's interesting is that, you know, the critique of our society as a narcissistic one long predates the web. And, you know, Christopher Lash's Culture of Narcissism came out in the 1970s. And it used to be that we thought that television was the great engine of narcissism because it fed our appetites. Now we have this medium in which actually we're doing a lot of the contributing to it ourselves. We're shaping it. A much larger number of people is shaping it. And yet we still have this criticism that it's narcissistic. Certainly, you can look out on the web and you can find websites in which people are gazing at their navels. There is no question that that's out there. But to be a successful blogger, the activity is much more social. It's about having a conversation with other people, linking to other people, reading what they're writing, listening to other people. And I find that most of the really successful bloggers, you know, really aren't, it's not fair to criticize them as narcissists. I think a lot of that critique comes from people who actually aren't out there reading blogs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about some of the individuals, and you really focus on a great many of them, that really were at the cutting edge of this as it evolved.
This person I start say everything with is a guy named Justin Hall, who was a college student in 1994 when he started his first website. And, you know, this was a time when the web was really mostly academic papers and research. And he looked at it very early on and said, you know, I can build a website and have it tell my story. And then he was also really interested in linking to other people. And these two activities, autobiography and linking, sort of became the foundation of the web, of blogging on the web. And what happened to Paul is really interesting. He did this, he blogged for about 10 years, did some really interesting stuff, became very popular for a time, and he fell in love with a woman who basically said to him, it's the blog or me, you know, make a choice. She didn't want their story to be so public. And he made, I think, the sensible decision in that situation. And so his story is sort of a really, you know, a symbolic one, I think, for everything that's come since. I also I tell the story of the people who founded Blogger. Evan Williams and Meg Hourihan and ran a small startup in the late 90s that created Blogger, which was this service that really took blogging out of the tech ghetto and brought it to a much wider audience. I talk about the political bloggers. I tell the story of Josh Marshall, whose site Talking Points Memo has been a real laboratory for ways that you can use blogs for investigative journalism. This is one of the sort of flashpoints in this argument about journalism and blogs, right? The notion that on blogs people really only express opinion, and what will happen if we wind up in a situation where financial problems of the media industry mean that newspapers aren't doing the investigative journalism they used to do. And in fact, there's more and more of that happening on blogs, and Talking Points Memo is a great example.
Talk a little bit about Evan Williams, because not only did he found Blogger and ultimately sold that to Google, but also is one of the driving forces behind Twitter now.
Yeah, so one of the interesting things is I went back and read a lot of the original blog posts of these people I was writing about. Evan Williams was the founder of the creator of Blogger, and he did it pretty much because he and his partner Meg Hourihan, in their company, needed a way to communicate with each other. They were actually in the same office, but they found that they were having trouble, you know, sharing links. If they put them in email, they would lose them, and so they just started this little website that had very brief items that they would share with each other, ideas for their business, links to things that interested them on the web. And then they said, you know, actually, if we're doing this already for ourselves, why don't we just post this on the web for other people? It'll help our business. It'll build some reputation for us. And it did. And then they said, this is working so well, why don't we make a tool that lets other people do it too? And that's how Blogger started. And what we see with Twitter today, interestingly, in Twitter where you can, it's almost like blogging, except you're limited to 140 characters for each post. And if you look at Evan Williams' original blog and then you go to Twitter today, they're remarkably similar. It's a kind of coming a full circle for him.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the evolution of the political blogs, because that's certainly been a big part of the popularity and the awareness of blogs.
Yeah, political blogging has been around almost as long as blogging itself, but it really took off originally in the days after 9/11, when people were feeling this wound and this desire to talk about it and to figure out what had happened. And interestingly, the original wave of political blogging was very heavily on the conservative side, which was certainly the dominant mood after 9/11. And there was this wave of bloggers who called themselves war bloggers. And their story, you know, was one of joining together in this outrage at what had happened. And calling for a militant response. And today, in response to that, after the Bush administration began pushing to invade Iraq, there was a sort of response on the other side of the political aisle. And a year or two later, we saw the rise of the sites that we now think of as the sort of liberal blogs, Daily Kos, mm-hmm. and many others. And today that that sort of wing of the political blogs is more prominent. People often, when they say the blogosphere, they're often referring just to the liberal and progressive side, the democratic side of blogging. And in fact, I don't think that there's any particular ideological tilt one way or the other. I think that blogs are now so common and widespread that they're going to reflect the mood of the country, and right now we're the conservatives and Republicans are sort of on the defensive, and so too are their blogs.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things that's part and parcel of any discussion about blogs, and you've mentioned it a couple of times, is the importance of links, and you devote some time to that in the book.
Yeah, this is something that we almost take for granted now. We know that when we're out on the web, we're going to be linked to many other places, but in the early days, a lot of the present, a lot of professional media sites and newspaper websites and so forth were very shy about linking out. They were afraid that if they linked to somewhere else on the web, you would click on that link and you would never come back, and that would hurt their businesses and hurt their readership and so on. And the people who started blogging were excited about sharing exciting things that they had found. Here, look at what I found. Look at this cool site. Or sharing news that was fresh. This is happening now. Here's a link. And they sort of taught, I think, the rest of us, and certainly a lot of people on the professional side, that was the heart of the web. That's what this medium is all about. And to suppress that or deny it for some business goal was sort of counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. What impact has social networking had on blogging?
Well, what's happened in this decade is that blogs really showed us all that the essence of the web was about allowing people to contribute to it, that that's the heart of this medium. And blogs were the first sort of avenue to doing that became really popular. And once that happened, the diligent and innovative software developers of Silicon Valley and elsewhere started figuring out other ways to make it easy for people to contribute to the web. And so we saw things like Flickr, which made it easy to post photos, and YouTube, which made it easy to post videos. And we also saw this genre of software that started actually a long time ago with something called Friendster and has since become much more popular with things like MySpace and Facebook that allow people to create these communities of friends and share things that way. And I see it all. I see all these things as sort of extensions of the impulse of blogging, which is the impulse to share stuff that you're excited about on the web. And I think, you know, to some extent, today it's easier to do this on something like Facebook or on Twitter, where you know you're not sort of committing to writing something in quite the level of ambition that you are with a blog. So that kind of social networking is now certainly much more widespread than blogging. There are millions of blogs today, but there are many more millions of people participating in the social networks.
Right. I mean, the statistics, I don't recall what they are. You may know. But the number of blogs that people start and then sort of leave dormant within a very short period of time turns out to be much more of an undertaking than they had initially anticipated.
That's true. But, you know, those figures are the same for Twitter and the same for Facebook and other activities. It's true. Any activity that is free, which all of these things essentially are today, invites what I think of as a kind of tire kicking. You know, you go and you start an account on a free blog service or on Twitter or something like that, and you check it out. And a lot of the time you do that, and then you move on. I have accounts on lots of blogging services that I started just to, you know, to see how they worked. And so that's, you know, it's a good reason to be skeptical about a lot of the numbers that you read in all these areas. But you know, they're all pretty hugely popular nonetheless. It's true that there's the statistic that's most commonly cited today is 130 million blogs worldwide. And then you look more closely at that and you see that actually only some much smaller percentage of those blogs are still active. Mm-hmm. So we might have 10 or 15 million active blogs today, but that's still an awful lot of blogs.
That's a lot. Is it encouraging? One of the other criticisms that blogs sometimes come under, and certainly other aspects of the media as well, but blogs in particular, is that people tend to gravitate only towards things that kind of agree with them, that support their own ideas, whether it's political or anything else, music, what have you, and that it doesn't create a wide enough opportunity for them to go outside of their comfort zone, essentially.
Yeah, this is sometimes called the echo chamber argument. And it's a really interesting question that I think ultimately isn't going to be resolved until we get better studies. There have been a few studies so far, and I look at them in Say Everything. My feeling is this. You don't when people make this complaint, they are observing discussions on political blogs, areas where they see somebody post something and a lot of other people say yes, yes, and agreeing. And, you know, that certainly happens. What I think they're missing is that on the web, you're never more than a link away from someone who disagrees with you. And the best blogs and the best bloggers are often challenging themselves. They're linking to people who disagree with them. And their most, you know, interested readers are actually following them. And so, the question is, are we better off today in a medium where I, as a relatively liberal reader, can actually go over to a conservative website and read what somebody who disagrees with me is saying, which I do, not constantly or obsessively, but I do occasionally, than in the previous world where I might subscribe to a magazine that is supportive of my views and would never do that, would never subscribe to a magazine that I disagreed with, because that involves, you know, spending money and committing to reading a lot of stuff that I might really not, that might not please me. So I still think the sum total in the world of the web of exposure to stuff that challenges our views is higher than it used to be. Should it be higher still? Are we at risk of people locking themselves away in an environment that just supports their views? Sure. But the alternative in the past has been, in most mainstream media, not let's expose our readers to lots of loudly conflicting views, but rather let's give our readers a kind of neutralized view of everything. Let's sort of do a little bit of on the other hand, journalism, but never really explore the more vibrant kind of conflict of more forthrightly expressed views. So I still think we're better off today.
Talk a little bit about the coexistence between blogging and journalism. It's a debate that seems to just go round and round these days.
It is an endless debate. And, you know, what I like to say today is that really the debate is, you can boil it down to fewer syllables than a haiku. It's really simple. You know, some bloggers do journalism and others don't. Journalism is an activity, right? It means you're actually trying to find out the truth. You're trying to research a subject and record things that you think are accurate depictions of reality. Some bloggers do that. Other bloggers just, you know, write about their opinions or what they had for dinner last night. Doing a blog can be journalism. And journalists now, many journalists blog. You know, the New York Times has something like 70 blogs on their website now. So these are, the conflict. There's a huge transition happening in the media today, and it has to do with the business. The business of newspapers is falling apart. The media are still trying to figure out how to make money on the web. And there's a lot of displacement of jobs, and these things make people upset. And sometimes they look for scapegoats, and I think that blogs, to some extent, have served as a scapegoat in that situation.
Right. It's interesting to think about that if the other economic dilemmas that the media and newspapers specifically are facing were somehow not as intense as they are for and they happen for a lot of other reasons, how blogging would be viewed. Blogging is viewed in the context sometimes of problems that have nothing to do with blogging.
Definitely. But, you know, the situation has already evolved. I think more and more journalists who've got their eyes open are seeing that, you know, yes, bloggers have a lot of loud complaints, sometimes justified, sometimes not, about mainstream media coverage. But that's not really the heart of the problem in journalism today. The heart of the problem is that the form of delivery has changed. People really get that if you want to know what's happening right now, the web can deliver it faster than a newspaper and in more depth than television. And that is what's going on.
Well, the recent protests in Iran were the penultimate example where blogs and the web was far more on top of it than anything in the mainstream media.
Yeah, it was Iran was an extreme case because the government didn't want a lot of, you know, professional media there and did their best to block the information that might come out on TV or through newspapers. So, you know, we were able to get at least some of it through other channels.
Who's on the cutting edge right now in terms of what's happening in the blogging world?
Well, if you mean, you know, who's inventing, you know, new things,
mm-hmm.
and you know, there are people doing work in social media where they're exploring what happens when you have a blog, but you're trying to connect it to Twitter and to Facebook, and you want to kind of understand what, you know, how all this stuff connects and what's next. There's a guy who a lot of people might know already named Robert Scoble, who was an early blogger in the tech world. He then went to work for Microsoft. I write about him a little bit in Say Everything. And he is always sort of, anytime somebody offers a new tool out there, he is figuring out, you know, how do I use this? And he's got a very infectious kind of enthusiasm for things, and sometimes I think he's overly enthusiastic about novelties, but he's a good guy to look at for that.
Mm-hmm. And are blogs something that is going to go out of fashion, do you think, that something will replace them, or are they here to stay for a while?
There's people in Silicon Valley who think that blogs are already, you know, sort of old-fashioned. And then there's other people who, you know, I talk to as I talk about this book who think, you know, blogging is still so new. I think they're here to stay. I think they will continue to change and evolve. You know, Twitter means now that people who want to do one-line blog posts are probably going to do them on Twitter rather than on their blogs. But that has made blogging, I think, more of a home for substance, for people who really want to post about their ideas and who want to argue the issues of the day, things like, you know, today, healthcare reform or the global warming, anything that involves a lot of detail and requires some understanding, blogging is just a great form for exploring, and I don't think it's going away anytime soon.
And finally, talk about the generational aspects of this, and certainly how young people look at all of this very differently.
I think young people see all of these things as a sea of stuff on the web for them to dip into and dip out of, and the arguments that obsess older people about what will happen to a world the world in which we all share the same we could all talk about the same stuff the next morning around the water cooler because we all watched it on television last night. That world is so far in the past, if it ever existed, that I think young people are not worrying about that.
Scott Rosenberg, his book is Say Everything, How Blogging Began and What It's Becoming and Why It Matters. It's just published by Crown. Scott, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks so much.